Call this meeting of the Judiciary Committee to order. Members take your seats. Chair recognizes a quorum. And today, members will be hearing two bills. First file, House File 745, Representative Herr, Marriages by Minors, Provisions Eliminated, and Proof of Age Required. Second is my bill, so Representative Mueller will take the gavel for that. Electronic Device Location Tracking Warrant Information Reporting Enabled. So first, can I have a motion to approve the minutes of February 7th?
So moved.
Representative Cantrell has moved the minutes. Any discussion? All in favor of the February 7th minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Minutes of February 7th are approved. So, first bill we have up is Representative Herr. There is no fiscal note. Representative Herr,
nope.
Go ahead and take the testifier's table. Marriages by minors, provisions eliminated, and proof of age required. Representative Herr, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Lesh and members. I'd like to move the House File 745 to be placed in the general registry.
That is the motion. We have the bill before us. Representative Herr, welcome to the committee. And tell us about your bill.
Thank you. So I'm here today to speak on House File 745, and this is to eliminate child marriages. Around the world, there are more than 700 million women lost their childhoods when they were married as children. For most of them, their marriage meant years of abuse, poverty, illness, and poverty for their children. Child marriages happen everywhere, even in the United States, even in Minnesota. Between 2000 and 2010, 248,000 children were married in the U.S. About 90% of these child marriages are girls being married to old men, men old enough that the sexual relationship would constitute statutory rape. These marriages happen in all groups, immigrant and refugee communities, in all religions, among people whose families have lived in this country for generations, and for people who are new arrivals. Child marriages were acceptable centuries ago, or even maybe a generation ago. Today we know that girls have to stay in school. Today we know that when young girls have babies, rates of infant mortality and maternal mortality are high. Today we know that there are simply no good outcomes. We're here to advocate for House File 475, a bill to ban all marriage in Minnesota to anyone under the age of 18. We'll hear from Dr. Ellen Kennedy, Executive Director of World Without Genocide and an adjunct professor at William Mitchell. She will talk about the bill and its content. Then we'll hear from a few other testifiers today, and I can call them up as we get to them. So if, Chair, with your permission, I could call up Dr. Ellen Kennedy to come make
a call. Them up. Thank you, Representative. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Kennedy, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Ellen Kennedy. Thank you, Chair Lesh and committee members, for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. A few years ago, I read an article about child marriage. The reporter related the story of an 11-year-old girl in Florida who had gotten married with judicial permission, according to the law in that state, and she married her 20-year-old rapist. The article described the girl's subsequent years of abuse and poverty in that marriage. I thought it was a horrific story, but as I read, I thought, child marriage, that's really a problem in Bangladesh or Tanzania, not in the United States. And then I came across the following sentence. Children 16 and under are still being married in Florida at a rate of one every few days. Again, I thought, well, that's only a problem in Florida. But I kept reading. The numbers in the U.S., as Representative Herr said, 248,000 children were married between the year 2000 and 2010. Child marriages were absolutely legal in every state in this country. Child marriage is legal in Minnesota. In Minnesota, a child can get married at age 16 or 17 with parental or judicial permission, just like in Florida. And estimates are that at least 250 children under 18 are married in Minnesota each year. A family or a judge make this happen legally. That's the procedure in Minnesota. But as Representative Herr said, there is no positive outcome. Children who marry are three times more likely to be beaten by their spouses, 31% more likely to live in poverty, 50% more likely to drop out of school, out of high school, 23% more likely to have a heart attack, diabetes, cancer, or stroke, and 50% more likely to be divorced than those who marry at age 18 or older. A report from the Georgetown Center for Education and the Workforce notes that 70% of the jobs in Minnesota now require post-secondary education. So what happens to a child in Minnesota who leaves school to get married? Our laws limit children from practices that they're not mature enough to handle, yet we let them marry when they may not yet even have a driver's license. And this is marriage, something that could have an impact for the rest of one's entire life. 2 years ago, a 17-year-old high school senior in the named Cassie Levesque learned that child marriage was happening in her state, like everywhere. She was a Girl Scout and decided to work on ending child marriage in New Hampshire as a Girl Scout project. She got a bill to the New Hampshire legislature. It didn't pass then, but 3 months ago, in the November election, Cassie Levesque got elected to the New Hampshire House of Representatives at age 18. We will soon hear from a 17-year-old, so perhaps we can get this passed now, and she may not have to work on it when she gets elected in another couple of years. Cassie Levesque is determined to raise the age, the minimum marriage age, to age 18 in her state, no exceptions. Both her grandmother and her great-grandmother were child brides. Cassie understands. The universal definition of child internationally is anyone under 18. Countries around the world, from Sweden to Pakistan, have recently passed laws saying no to child marriage because the research and the outcomes that I referred to are clear. And these outcomes are abuse, poverty, divorce, illness. This isn't what we want for anyone, and we certainly don't want this for children in Minnesota. We urge you to limit marriage in Minnesota to adults, please, and thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Kennedy. Questions from members of the committee for Dr. Kennedy? Thank you very much. Dr. Kennedy, please stick around if we have questions afterwards. Please call your next testifier, Representative.
Next testifier is Ashlyn Kenzier, a lawyer with Gender Justice.
Welcome, Ms. Kenzier. Please introduce yourself for the committee. Begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak with you this morning. My name is Ashlyn Kenzier, and I am here to testify in support of House File 745. As was stated, I am an attorney with Gender Justice, a local nonprofit that focuses on gender equity, and I am here today in my individual capacity to support this legislation. And today, I want to explain the legal situation for children who marry and what recourse they have if they are in an abusive relationship. As was previously stated, the minimum age to marry in Minnesota is 18, but there are exceptions that allow a child of 16 or 17 years of age to get married with their parents, legal guardians, or the court's decisions. So a child's parents or legal guardian must first appeal to the court in order for that child to get married. The judge then decides whether to grant that license. There is no special formula, and the judges are granted great discretion in these cases. Judges usually grant the license because parental rights are highly regarded in this country, and the judges trust the parents' decision to marry off that underage child, regardless of what the child thinks and regardless of whether marriage is actually in the best interests of that child. One reason child marriage is harmful is because whether someone is married has an impact on sexual misconduct laws in this state. Minnesota has what are commonly known as marital rape exceptions. This means that conduct that would otherwise be considered rape or other sexual misconduct is perfectly legal in this state if the victim and the perpetrator are married. For example, under Minnesota law, it is illegal to have sex with a 16 or 17-year-old child if you are more than 4 years older than that child and in a position of authority. However, that very same conduct is legal if the victim and the perpetrator are married. Even if the rape or other misconduct occurred prior to the marriage, most prosecutors will decline to prosecute because the marriage is seen as taking precedence and they don't want to disturb the family unit. Please consider that victim survivor in that situation. She has already survived a sexual assault, but once she is married to her abuser, there are almost no consequences Imagine knowing at 16 or 17 years old that the legal system has written off your assault and has given your perpetrator absolute immunity for their actions. Finally, I want to discuss the legal recourse for a child who is married. Children, because they are under the age of 18, cannot legally sign contracts, rent apartments, or individually hold credit cards. They cannot rent or purchase cars alone, and they cannot access health care or check themselves into a hospital. Abuse, as we have heard, is pervasive in these relationships. But a married child cannot file for divorce or even seek an order for protection on their own because that would require them to sign a legal document, which they cannot do because they are under the age of 18. Many battered women's shelters will not accept abused persons who are under the age of 18. And I want to stress that point. If you are in an abusive marriage and you are a child, you may not be able to stay at a battered women's shelter. In addition, you may not be able to turn to your parents for support because they're the ones who signed your marriage license in the first place. A child bride or groom who is the victim of abuse often has nowhere to go and therefore remains in that abusive relationship, oftentimes with children involved. Child marriage is legal in Minnesota, but it absolutely should not be. I urge you to support House File 745 and ban child marriage in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kinzier. Any questions from the members of the committee for Ms. Kinzier? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just out of curiosity, since, if they're a child that's married under the age of 18, if they're being abused, would they be eligible under CHIP statute, Children in Need of Protection?
I'm not certain what the implications are for CHIP.
Yeah, I just am curious. I don't know if anybody else around the table knows, but just curious.
Does anyone else around the table know? Or smart research people, they'll look it up. I'm not putting you on the spot, unless you know, Ms. Mullen. Why don't you think about it? We'll get back to you. Okay. Ms. Kinzier, I got a question. So there's an 18-year-old kid in Thief River Falls who manages the local Dairy Queen. Mm-hmm. Okay, and he gets married to his 17-year-old girlfriend and gets her a job at the local Dairy Queen also. He's now in a position of authority. Prior to marriage, that would be statutory rape. But in marriage, that sexual act is protected because of what you refer to as the marital rape exception. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Is it your testimony that you really do think that individual should be prosecuted for a third degree criminal sexual conduct or fourth degree in that situation?
Mr. Chair, the law says that you have to be 4 years or older than that person and in a position of authority. So an 18-year-old who marries a 17-year-old would not qualify under that statute.
Okay, so a 21-year-old, that in your opinion, that should be prosecuted?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Any other questions from members of the committee? Okay, thank you for your testimony, Ms. Kinzier.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, I can shed a little bit of light on the order for protection question and the CHIPS question simply by indicating that under Section 518B01, Subdivision 4, a person that is a minor who is 16 years or older may make a petition for an order of protection under the Domestic Abuse No Contact Order statute.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Herb.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have two more testifiers. The next person is Fortune Welly, and she is a Somali women's. She is the executive director of a Somali women's advocacy organization.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Welly. Introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and member of committee. This issue is so complex. My name is Fortune Welly. I'm Somali American. I have over 20 years public health and healthcare experience. And also lead an ethnic-led nonprofit organization called Isrun that primarily works with Somali women and their families. When I was asked to testify for this bill, I wasn't sure what to say because I thought this was a third world and developing world issue. But I'm here to talk about the health impact of a child marriage. There are three reasons why young girls are married. Number one, as everyone talked about, poverty. Families are marrying off their daughters because they cannot afford to keep them at home. And because of economic reasons, they're married off. The second thing is that girls are married is because they're invested, they're seen as economic outcome. And so the dowries that are given, families are thinking they're making off of resources. And the third reason that young girls are married off is to keep them the good girls before they start premarital sex. They're married off, and so to protect rape, unintended pregnancies, sexual transmitted disease, and all that. But we know that based on research globally, WHO and everyone else shows that the violence that child marriage brings to the health impact have been researched. Social isolation and depression is number one. That girls who are married off as a young age, they have to follow the rules that the person who had married. So they're rejected, they're socially isolated, tend to person who married older, and they're totally in depression and not so healthy. And also that shuns their development as well. The other problem is that people think getting married a young girl, that they're protecting STD and STI and sexual transmitted disease. Based on the research, it says otherwise. Child marriage, especially girls who are married older men, tend to have higher HIV and HPV, which is sexual transmitted disease, because the men who marry tend to have multiple sexual partners. Also, according to the WHO, the risk of having a child, having a baby, is very high. According to the World Health Organization, girls between age 10 and 14 years old are 5 to 7 times more likely to die on birth, on childbirth. Also, the girls between the age of 15 and 19 years old are also twice likely to die in childbirth. Also, the risk is not only the young mom who's having baby, the risk for the infant. The infant mortality is also about 80% of these young girls that are having. Higher for emotional immaturity, lack of access and reproductive health services, and high risk of infectious disease. In conclusion, the reasons girls are married are poverty, income, and also other problems. What I'm hoping to say here is that when young girls get married, we're not only losing their lives, their productivity, but also they're having babies. We're losing their livelihood. The work we do here, we see telltale signs of young girls have been married when they were young in refugee camps. And one day they just discover they're 25-year-olds and they have 7 kids. They're unable to read, they're unable to write, and all of a sudden they're panicked and they want to get out. I hope that we as Americans, we as Minnesotans, wanted to be the voices of all young girls around the world. And I want us to stop this early marriage for young girls so then we can go out and protect the young girls that are waiting us to be saved. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Welly. Any questions from members of the committee for Ms. Welly? Thank you, Ms. Welly. Please stick around in case we have questions thereafter. Representative Hur, you have a final testifier?
Yes, our final speaker is Chloe, and she's a high school student, and she's one of the many children advocating for an anti-child marriage.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Morse, and please introduce yourself.
Good morning.
I'm sorry, what's your name?
What?
Tell me your name again.
Chloe Morse.
It was, Ms. Morse. Okay.
Right.
Great.
Good morning, Chair Lesh and members of the committee. My name is Chloe Morse. Thank you for the opportunity to share my thoughts on this legislation with you today. I'm a constituent of Representative Hur, and I would like to thank her for sponsoring this important bill. I was shocked when I first heard about the prevalence of child marriage in the United States and right here in our own state of Minnesota. I had always assumed that child marriage happened some other place in countries on the other side of the globe where the issue is disconnected from my personal reality and where I could do little to combat it. This seemed to be most people's reaction. I am 17 years old and a senior in high school. When I look around me at my peers, I see we are all at a pivotal point in our lives. We are defining our identities, making decisions about our future, and preparing to enter a new stage in our lives as we enter adulthood. People my age are learning how to be independent, but a child marriage impedes development of this independence. This is because the reality is that in the majority of child marriages, the power dynamics are lopsided due to differing ages. When we're talking about child marriage, we're really talking about child brides, younger girls being married to older men. child brides are dependent on their husbands. This makes it difficult for them to leave or escape if there is abuse, and research has documented that there is almost always abuse. In addition, minors don't have any legal recourse. When I learned about the presence of child marriage in Minnesota and its devastating effects on the lives of girls, I knew I had to act. First, I arranged for a trip of high school students to visit Senator Sandy Pappas last year to talk with her about this bill, its importance, and how we could take action. Since then, I have been on a live radio show and TV show speaking on child marriage and why advocacy around this issue is important to me. I am also working with World Without Genocide to present a program on child marriage this Saturday, February 16th at Highland Park Public Library, free and open to the public, to educate the general public about this issue and this bill. Child marriage is an issue anywhere in the world, but here in Minnesota, we can do something about it. Please vote to approve House File 745. We can make child marriage illegal here, with no exceptions.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Morris. Any questions from members of the committee? Ms. Morris, thank you very much, Ms. Morris. Please stick around in case we have questions for you hereafter. Representative Considine.
Not for Ms. Morris.
Okay.
I thought we were getting a little next.
Well, we're going to ask for any public testimony from folks in the audience, but before we do that, we're going to ask if anyone has any questions for Representative Herr. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Herr, thank you very much for bringing this bill forward. As the mom of three girls, I can't imagine them having to go through this, so I'm grateful. But I do have a couple questions.
Sure.
First of all, do you know how many child marriages there are in Minnesota, and then what the ages of both people are? And then secondly, since we heard the bill on marital rape last time, and we seem to be dealing with that, how does that change, if anything, your concerns on this issue? Sure. Thank you.
Rips of her.
Thank you, Chair Lesh, Representative Robbins. So we don't have a lot of good data. We know that some of our surrounding states, we've actually pulled a lot of the information from them. But maybe what I can do is defer to our House research. I think we had materials that showed some numbers around this.
Anyone in House research want to venture in? Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, on the chart that was passed out, it doesn't appear that there are statistics for Minnesota that I could see. That might have something to do with, they don't keep track. They probably, you'd probably have to go to each registrar's office for those marriages.
Ms. Kensier, I bet you has an answer. You got an answer, Ms. Kensier?
Yes, Minnesota is one of 12 states in this country that does not retain or report any data on child marriages, so you would have to, as you stated, individually call all of the counties and have them collect that data.
So this committee would have to create a data set and go through that. That's what we do here. Thank you for that answer. Any Representative Cobb? You had a second question, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I just wondered, since we've already looked at the marital rape issue in the committee and are dealing with that, does that change anything? Or obviously, there's still a lot of other concerns. Just wanted your feedback on that. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Lesh and Representative. So it does for me. This is a personal question. So for me, it doesn't change anything because all of the health outcomes, the impact on the well-being of the mother and her children, on just on opportunities for that young woman doesn't change because we changed that marital rape law. So it would still be important for us to move forward with this bill.
Thank you, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. And before I ask any question, I'd like to point out that I am a co-author on the bill.
Duly noted.
This is set to take effect August 1st, 2019. If you have people that go in July and get married, are they grandfathered in, or the ones that are currently there, are they grandfathered in, or are they considered null and void? And I do have one more question. Well, I'll ask at the same time, which is, you have somebody that comes in from Kentucky or Kansas that is legally married, and they're 21 and 16. What do we do?
Full faith and credit clause. Okay. Representative Herr, do you want to phone a friend on that? I mean, it's kind of... Unless you can answer it, go ahead.
Chair Lesh, Representative. So we do have some information around that, and House Research could maybe help correct this if what I'm saying is incorrect, but that the effective date is the effective date. So if you're married before that, it doesn't impact your legal marriage. The only time that this does impact is that if you're from another state as well and your marriage was recognized there, if you come to Minnesota, it's recognized here. The only time that it wouldn't be is if somehow after that date you you lied about that your age and that you were legal, that you were 18, and then later on if you wanted to get benefits, and then that would be void. That particular marriage would be void.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering about the enforcement of this and how that's going to happen, because I know there may be different cultures or religions that maybe they don't go to the courthouse and get the proper documentation, but they still call it marriage. And so how do you enforce those marriages, and how do you rescue those girls from that plight?
Representative Herr.
Chair Lesh, Representative, so we thought actually quite a long time about that particular question. Right now, that if you are, let's say, in the Hmong culture, if you're Hmong married but you don't have a marriage certificate, in those marriages, the spouse is not entitled to benefits, it's not entitled to any of that would come along. So being culturally married doesn't give you all the rights of being legally married. And so this bill, in essence, wouldn't change that. The thing that second part of your question about how do we enforce it in those particular situations, I don't think that there would be any way for us to enforce it, because we can't enforce it now. If a 14-year-old is married to a 15-year-old, which does happen, we can't enforce that right now either. So, and there's no way to know about that.
Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Herr, for bringing this bill. It's I know many people, when they hear child marriage, they think it's third world country problem, but I know that many immigrant communities and even mainstream communities, this is an existence and it's a problem. Just the one question that I had, Representative Scott already asked, for communities that don't go through the legal system to get married and don't have a marriage certificate, how would we be able to help those girls? How can we get them out of those marriages? If we were able to reinforce this bill and make it a statute, like, is there an amendment we can add, or is for cultural marriages, or I'm just curious, because I know that happens a lot in immigrant communities. In my community, it happens that people get married through the Islamic way but don't necessarily seek to get marriage license from the court system.
Chair Lesh, Representative Hassan. So I think that this law doesn't, again, impact that the way we do outreach now, we know that those marriages are already happening at this point, and that organizations like those that are run by Fortune, I mean, those are we need to continue to support those organizations to be able to identify these women and support them and help them out of these types of marriages. But again, this particular bill doesn't address that, and I wish that there were a way. I think that a couple of years ago, there was an effort to identify cultural marriages and what that meant and to codify that in law, but it did not pass. And so that is actually a much more complicated situation than this bill would be able to address or encompass. And so I think that those are things we need to continue to think about if we're looking to protect all girls, how we're actually going to do that in law without in honoring cultures, but also knowing that there is a time and place where now young child marriages are no longer needed or accepted. And so that's another discussion for a bigger discussion for another day.
Thank you, Representative Herr. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, a couple of my questions have been answered. One I was going to ask about the data here, what's issued in Minnesota, because I kept talking about Florida and other states. But since we don't keep the data, and I don't think we should get that data, and like I know your position on the government collecting data and how to secure it, it's a big issue. But my concern is, how do we protect our children when they can, the parents, if they want to do this, like in Florida, was it 12 years old, a child getting married? Parents bringing the kids down to a different state. You having them get married, then we have that full faith and credit clause that we have to deal with at this end when they come back to Minnesota. Like my brother, he ended up going to Florida, filed for a license down there, and got married an hour later. Is there something that you could possibly, and I don't know if research could help you, put this, try to deal with that, where if it's a child marriage, an amendment of some type, that marriage would not be recognized in the state of Minnesota if they were under 18, the age of 18 when they were married?
Representative Herr.
Chair Lesh, Representative Johnson. So actually, under this particular bill, if you are a Minnesotan and you went to another state to get married, your marriage would actually be void here. It would not be enforceable here.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for the author before we move to public testimony? If you do have, there are other members of the public who wish to testify, please come forward and make your statements on the record. While you do, I don't have a question, but I would state, Representative Herr, I have a modicum of reservation only to this extent. My grandmother and grandfather were 17 and 18 when they got married. He was going off to the war, World War One, in fact. That's why I'm here in this much time. Most people say, oh, you assume Second World War. No, it was actually World War One. He went off to the Navy. That was probably a dumb decision. When I was a commander in the Army, I had all kinds of privates make stupid decisions, like getting married before they get deployed and everything. It was almost always a bad decision. That said, I'm glad I'm here. So it was a different time. I get it. And times have changed, I like to try to attempt to create uniform standards to the extent we can, despite the fact that times change. Now, my mom, when she got married, was 28. My dad was 35. By 28, 1978, she said that people were already calling her an old maid because she was 28 when she was going to get married. Her three boys, including me, got married way too young. I got married at 22. My other brother got married at 22, and my younger brother got married at 23. That was a stupid decision, too. I was way too young and stupid to get married at 22. So mind that, all you with the red name tags up there, 22 is too young and stupid to get married, okay? All right? That said, I'm really glad that I have my daughter, and I appreciated my marriage with my ex-wife, too. She's a good person. I don't regret that time. But if someone told me that I didn't have the legal right to do that at that age, even though I was too young and stupid, I would probably take some umbrage at that. Do you have any reservation that in asserting that, nope, we're going to make it 18, that we are removing moral agency from young women and their ability to make a decision, especially when it comes to, say, the question of choice? Okay, very sensitive topic around here. Very much argued about when a person has a moral agency to make a legal decision like that. Do you have any concerns that by drawing this line of demarcation at 18 that we are removing agency from young women in their ability to make decisions for themselves and their own body at all? And if not, why?
Chair Lesh, thank you for the question. It was kind of a long question, so I hope I remember it correctly to answer. So right now we already take a lot of agency away from people who are not considered adults, right? You can't drink until you're 21. You can't smoke until you're 18. We're looking to raise that in different cities to raise that that age to 21 as well. We've already told young people that your brain is not fully developed till your mid-20s, and so we have already decided we would regulate their agency already, and so I do not have a problem with this particular, raising marriage age to 18. I have a 19-year-old daughter who, when she was 16, was dating a 19-year-old boy, very briefly, and I took her hand and brought her to the police station, and I told an officer to tell her why that was wrong, that it's not because her mother is telling her that it's wrong, it's because the law tells her it's wrong. And when I said it to her, she did not listen, but when the police officer said it to her, she broke it off with that boyfriend. And the officer asked her, he said, What do you think of if you saw another man dating, he's innocent, and he's a man, he's 19, he's going to be 20, you're a child. What do you think if you saw that in somebody else? What would you think of that man? And she said, well, I would think he didn't have very good judgment and he wasn't thinking about the girl. And then he said, then think about the same thing for you. And today she's going to college on the East Coast. She's a Dean's List student. She's going to be traveling. Last year she traveled to Spain to study. She's going to Laos to study, to Thailand to study anthropology this summer. Had my child fought me the way that she did and married this boy, she would not have the life that she has right now. So I have no problem in saying letting the law decide that 18 is the age you can get married at, because my 16-year-old had no wherewithal to be able to make that decision for herself.
Thank you for that answer, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question and then a comment. So my question is about the full faith and credit issue, and maybe it's more to staff, whether there's any limit to the requirement that we recognize marriages from other states. You know, are we under the full faith and credit clause? If somebody's married at 11, are we required to recognize that marriage when they come into Minnesota? There must be some limit. So that would be my first question.
Who's taking over that? Ms. Mullen?
Chair and members, I'm happy to look into that offline and send you an email about it. I'd have to do some research. The age with marriages has slowly been changing over the last few years in different states, and I don't know if there is a lot of law in that area as to how other states have interpreted recognizing other marriages, but I can look for that and send it to you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And so I think that would be good. I'm a little bit troubled by the perhaps unequal treatment here based on, you know, where somebody got married or, you know, residency and all of that. The other thing I just wanted to kind of comment, Mr. Chair, on what you said about the 17 and 18-year-old grandparents and stuff. And you did say that the world has changed. And I think that's a big key here. I mean, there are a lot of standards that we used to accept that we don't accept anymore. And I think part of this is that the role of women and the expectations that women have and the, thank goodness, the way women are viewed is changing a lot. And women expect to be able to be full human beings and be autonomous and have educations and be able to manage their own finances. I mean, there was one time when women couldn't own property. And women couldn't even consent to marriage. It was the family that consented, and so on and so on. And we don't accept those things anymore. And I take your point that a lot of this is who we imagine the people are and what we imagine their thinking process is. And unfortunately, we in the legislature have to make laws for everybody that cover everybody the same. And we can't say, you know, here's a situation where the woman is fully advised and really does want to be married and she's really mature and that one's okay, but this other one's not, even though they're the same age. We just don't have the ability to do that. And I would say too that, you know, kind of the as birth control has come into the picture, sexual mores have changed, you know, for good or for ill. Just the sort of our expectations of people and what the meaning is of getting marriage has changed. And I think I have to say I do have some kind of little bit of concern about how the bill plays out, and the author knows about that. But in terms of the agency question and saying no one should marry before the age of 18, I don't have a concern about that. I think it's entirely appropriate in today's world. You know, and of course it's equal. It's not a gender-based thing. It also will apply to men. But mainly it's the women who have been hurt by early marriage, maybe before they understand fully what their opportunities will be, as Representative Herr has mentioned. And I just think back to myself at 16, and I thought I knew everything. But, in fact, I didn't. So I think it's a good bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now.
I do now.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got you beat by a couple of years. I was married at 19, and my then wife of over 21 years now was 18 years old. But I wanted to add on to the research question in terms of, in addition to states, how about international? I don't know if that's been addressed, but would international marriages, would we recognize those? For example, I know we recognize international birth certificates, but would that be included in this?
Representative Herr, you want to take a shot at it, or Ms. Mullen? Go ahead, Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, the way the bill is written right now, it's another state or foreign jurisdiction. So right now, if we were, we do recognize foreign marriages, and this bill would say that if they were married under 18 and one of them was a resident of the state at the time, so if they went to, I don't know. Yeah, any foreign country and were married, the bill would apply to the foreign jurisdiction marriage the same way it applies to other states.
Representative Lucero?
Thank you. One quick follow-up then. What if they were both, under what you just mentioned, it would be, one would have to be a Minnesota resident married internationally to somebody under 18. What if they were both foreign, so neither one was a Minnesota resident and then came to Minnesota?
Chair and members, the way this bill is written, that marriage would still be recognized.
Thank you. Any other questions for members of the committee? Seeing none, we are prepared to vote. We're prepared to vote, Dr. Kennedy, unless it was really urgent and pressing to clarify it incorrect. Okay. Closing comments, Representative Herr.
And I just wanted to take a moment to say a couple of words in closing. I want to share a quick story with all of you that when I was a minor, I was at a community event where an older man saw me for just a brief moment. And that man's family called my father a few days later asking for my hand in marriage. I remember hearing my father say to the caller that he would only entertain the thought of us marrying after I graduated from college. Had my father not been my advocate, my life outcome would have been very different. I would have never graduated high school. I would have never gone away to a college that was hours from my home, which for my time, you couldn't leave your house unless you were getting married, and I went to college away from home. I would have never met my husband at school. I would have never lived all over the country to advance my career. Most importantly, I would not be here today, sitting here as a state legislator, introducing a bill to eliminate a practice that takes opportunities that I had from other girls who didn't have an adult to advocate for them the way my father did. So yes, there may be some unintended consequences that impact a few people. We cannot let a practice that reduces a girl's chance of success, happiness, security, safety continue, and not just for girls, but for boys as well. That this is about both gender. We are the adults who know better, so we should do better to protect our children. Thank you, Chair Lush, and members, for hearing House 745 to eliminate the provision of allowing marriages by minors.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Herr's motion is that House File 745 be placed on the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes unanimously. House File 745 is placed on the general register. Thank you for the testimony. Thank you, all the testifiers. I very much appreciate you being here today. Representative O'Neill?
Just quickly, I was looking at the previous minutes, and even though we took a roll call vote, the roll call is not listed. So I know that we already approved the minutes, but maybe that could be a correction, please.
Oh, okay. Do we have the ability to correct? So was that the 16-0?
Yes, that's vote? Correct.
Can we just do that now? Can you make a motion for the correction, Representative O'Neill? I'll move to reconsider the passage of the minutes. All in favor of reconsidering the minutes of February 7th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The minutes are on the table right now. Do you care to make your motion to modify, Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Yes, so the motion is that the 16 A's and the 0 nays should be listed by name as to who was the yeses. Apparently there were no noes, but the committee was not complete at that time. So my motion would be that would be a roll call vote and listed as such.
Okay, so we don't technically have the ability to do that now because we don't have the names listed. We would probably need that in written form because there are 18 members of this committee and we can't just say everybody.
Let's bring
those back next hearing. We'll correct those. So the minutes stand as not approved right now. We reconsider the motion. Thank you for pointing that out, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair Lush.
Okay. Vice Chair Moeller is taking over. Well, I'm going to move House File 631. What's the motion on this? Yeah. Possible inclusion in the data practices omnibus bill.
Wait over.
Oh.
Okay, members, the bill we're hearing next is House File 631. This is the bill we originally heard for informational purposes on January 31st, and it is the same bill as 2018's House File 2309, which was part of the vetoed omnibus bill last year. And Chair Lesh, would you like to move this bill before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in the data practices omnibus bill?
I would, Madam Chair.
All right. And Chair Lesh, I believe you have an author's amendment labeled DE1. May I have a motion to put the bill in the form the author wants?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Lesh. Does everybody have the amendment? Are there any discussions about the amendment? Yep. Representative Johnson.
Chair, I wonder if this is quite an expansive change from the original bill that we discussed. I would request that Chair Lesh explain this amendment a little bit. I've had a number of different organizations contact me about this amendment, and there's some a little bit of a concern on it.
Okay. Chair Lesh.
Well, Madam Chair, I would ask that we still vote on the motion to get the bill in the shape that the author requires, which is custom and usage. We're not passing the bill today, and it's my intent to go over everything on that. In fact, I'm not going to be talking mostly. It's going to be other folks, including law enforcement, is going to come forward, and I'm going to be talking with them about that. So I would still ask that we vote to get the bill in the shape that the author desires.
Okay, now. Thank you, Chair Lesh. So seeing that the motion is to get the bill in the shape that the author desires, Chair Lesh moved that motion. Any more discussion on that motion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
If I could, Madam Chair, we've got Minnesota Coalition on Government Information is going to be coming up to explain it. I think Rich Neumeister is going to be speaking on it, too. He has some reservations about shifting the reporting requirement to the applicant. I don't know if anyone from the courts is going to testify today. I hope so, but a little bit of work in progress. That's it, Madam Chair, for now.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Ealing, would you introduce yourself? Welcome back to the committee again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. We're here to offer our support for making a statutory clarification that the disclosure requirements for tracking warrants under 626A.42 are distinct from other electronic monitoring orders issued under other portions of 626A, and that tracking warrants should be treated under their own discrete standard as already provided by law. And the reason for this change and clarification is to ensure transparency around the use of cell phone location tracking technology as was first intended by the legislature in 2014. Now, when the tracking warrant framework was first put in place, it established an important probable cause standard for the use of cell phone tracking technology, but it also included specific disclosure and reporting requirements. And these requirements included the transmission of a report to the legislature about the use of tracking warrants, as well as notification to the parties who had been surveilled after the termination of the warrant period. And the original 2014 law also required that tracking warrants should generally be unsealed after the objective of the warrant had been accomplished. And so from our perspective, these reporting and disclosure requirements are just as important as the overall probable cause standard established by the 2014 law, because without disclosure, it is difficult to verify the uses to which tracking warrants are being put, as well as to determine the overall scope of the technology's use. We would note that since the late 1960s, statutory transparency requirements regarding electronic surveillance have been a critical part of the oversight of surveillance technologies. For instance, in 1968, at really the beginning of the inception of the modern era of electronic surveillance regulation, Congress put in place reporting requirements for the use of wiretaps in criminal cases, and we have analogs in our current law that were put in place at roughly the same time, shortly thereafter. And they recognized that the use of such a potentially invasive tool required disclosure in order to provide some substantive oversight of governmental power. In a more recent example, Congress passed the USA Freedom Act in 2015, and that required more public disclosure about the function of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which issues surveillance warrants and orders in national security cases. And calls for this additional disclosure came after the public learned that the FISA court had been issuing extremely broad surveillance orders that authorized the government to collect telephone calling records, really about all calls within the United States as well as international calls. And I'd note that the scope of this data collection was much, much broader than the statutory language that was being relied on to authorize it. And the public and lawmakers simply did not know that this was being done until a FISA court order was made public and people could look at it. And so the importance of seeing the details of what a warrant actually authorizes is a critical part of oversight, and since it demonstrates how the legal authority that underpins the warrant is really being used in actuality. And so that's the purpose of this bill, so that the warrants for tracking warrants can be unsealed eventually and seen by the public for oversight purposes. In regards to the question of the change about who provides notification, in the law enforcement, warrant process, physical notification is provided by the law enforcement agency if you're serving a physical warrant. But historically, in the electronic surveillance authority area under 626A, the courts have been providing notice after warrants are unsealed, providing notice to the parties who are surveilled. And that's been the language that was initially put in the 2014 law, that the courts would provide notice. So we'd just like to have a discussion and see how this would actually work if you shift the notification duty to law enforcement agencies as opposed to the court in the surveillance context. As a final historical matter, I think it's important to note that this entire debate about tracking warrants would not be occurring, and we would not have the 2014 law if it had not been for a data practices request made by a citizen requester. Mr. Neumeister, who is here, made a data request that really unpacked this entire debate. And when those kinds of things happen, when a data request has led to substantive policy change, we always like to let the legislature know about that because it underscores the importance of the Data Practices Act. So thank you, Madam Chair. I'll stand for questions if you have any.
Great. Thanks. Any members have questions? Mr. Ealing, I have one. So what exactly prompted the change then from the courts providing notification to law enforcement?
I'll defer to Chair Lesh. It's in the amendment to 631.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I will confess that I have not enjoyed being put in this position of having to figure out who's on first. The courts have law enforcement initially 5 years ago objected to being the ones to notify because it was the courts who were signing off on the warrant. The courts have objected to, I think that was the reason that I recall. I don't know if Mr. Ealing can recall, but the courts have objected to, since we passed the last law, to being the person who notifies, the entity that notifies, because they don't have the contact information, as I understand, for the person who is notified. As far as I'm concerned, that's the reason for a public committee hearing, to find out kind of really what's going on. I think I bought the court's line on this one. I think I did, which is the reason for the language change. But honestly, I would really love for people to testify and come down and say why they should or shouldn't be the people who does the notification. Because I'm not sure I really know. So I hope we'll hear that out in committee. Like I said, the pitch has been made to me on both sides, and I'm like, I don't know, okay, fine. The applicants are going to do it, but we'll see what bears out in testimony. I'm an open book.
All right, any questions right now? And I believe, Mr. Neumeister, you wanted to testify about this bill. Please come on forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. In 2012, 2013, I started making a bunch of data requests about administrative subpoenas, devices, things that law enforcement is doing in this field. I wanted to do something just in general, in a broad kind of context. I stumbled across the use of a device. Hennepin County, they use a kingfish, which was a little thing, but the BCA had stingrays, which they spent approximately nearly $1 million over a period of a decade for this device, upkeep of the device. You, the policymakers, nobody knew about it. And so what was happening the little phone in your pocket or whatever Android you might have or whatever the technology was developing was being used to track people, being used by law enforcement in Minnesota with a less than a search warrant. It was done, could have been relevant to a location, relevant to an investigation, could have been reasonable, I mean, or a standard of a pen register or a trap and trace device, which is very less than a probable cause. So what happened in 2014, I went to Joe Atkins, a DFLer, Brandon Peterson, I was going to say an IR, that shows you how old I am, but a Republican, and it was all done, and John played, Representative Lesh, Representative Scott, everybody played into a role in this. It was a big fight, but we noticed then 5 years later, as in the previous informational hearing, people like myself, media, and all that wanted to know, where are we at? Because all the two things that were going to be, accountability and transparency, the warrants, tracking warrants were going to be public, so we can see what's happening. And then the individuals were going to be notified, hey, you were being tracked, just like they do in wiretaps. So it was nothing new. And that responsibility was done on the judiciary. And it's been like that since 1969 when you did adopt 626A. And to the best of my knowledge, when the bill was done in 2014, it was also to include the judiciary. Since that time, there have been two swipes at the bill, at that issue, particularly when the media found out that, as Representative Lesh pointed out in a expose by numerous folks, up to at least to the last report, nearly 2,700 tracking warrants or combination of tracking warrants with other warrants or portions of that are not public, and they should be. So last year, this bill was introduced, went out. And those, if you look at the original bill, and if you look at the Delete Everything Amendment, that includes Section 1 and Section 3. That is basically the language from the original bill that's in the amendment. So that's where we're all at, and where do I sit on this as someone who's followed this and the importance. All I know is it's harder than pulling teeth for law enforcement to be upfront, from my point of view, as to what the heck they're doing with the new technologies. And it's publicly documented before the legislature. We came to this hard-fought compromise, at least for this, on this item, that search warrants are public and people get notified. And I would hate to lose that after 5 years of this law. So that's my goal. Those are my two goals. Now, does the law in general need clarification? Yes. And those are some of those amendments that are on there. And I'm generally in favor of those. The ones of doing the responsibility, kicking over the responsibility to the law enforcement, I don't accept. Now, the thing is that, you know, these folks are going to have to come down and tell you what they specifically do. For me, the bottom line is the search warrants should be public, and I hope the law is clear on that. So when I'm 70 years old, I'm still not fighting that issue if I'm still alive and I'm still participating in the process. The second item is the one, and they're arguing with each other, and where publicly no one has, neither of those folks have come up before you. Now, one of the reasons why I would favor the judiciary is, one, historically they've done that. Unless they come up and say, we don't notify people who are individual subjects of wiretaps. Number two, when you have law enforcement, there's hundreds of agencies with courts. They've got 10 judicial districts. Now, we don't have the address to where to notify them. Well, whatever the last address is on their court record or whatever it may be, that's where you can send the certified letter to or whatever. So the bottom line, this is an important piece of legislation. It's continuing the transparency and accountability that the legislature intended in 2014. Now, are there other kinds of technologies and other kinds of issues that are bubbling underneath this? There are. just as Minnesota Public Radio reported last Friday, after Tony Webster looked at public search warrants, raising questions of how law enforcement are using new technology, and that even you did not know about it, and now this bill has nothing to do with it, but it's related. So, importance of accountability and transparency as technology changes. Basically, for decades, as I have no problem saying, law enforcement doesn't want the public to know a lot about this until they're caught with their pants down, as I've been involved in with four, five, six major issues over the past several years, even back in 1988 and 89. 90. I mean, I can go on and on. But the bottom line is here, at least there's some agreement for some transparency and accountability. And one of the reasons why about this Stingray or kind of devices, because it's still secret to some extent. There are allegations, and public documents have said that they're used for interception purposes with add-ons, with software. With us, with those public warrants, or those warrants being made public, the public and you, the policymakers, will know what's going on, particularly with these kind of pieces of equipment when hundreds of thousands of dollars are being spent. And the second thing is that individuals who are the subjects of these and are garnered in it will be notified. Those are two easy, simple things. So if you're going to adopt the amendment, this is what I would suggest you do. Keep Section 1, take out Section 2. Keep Section 3. Take out Section 4. Keep Section 5, because Section 5 is very important. Because one of the things that we discovered, when I say we, I mean there's some policymakers here, and myself and others, there's a difference between a mobile tracking device and using a device to follow a phone. The mobile tracking device is you put something on your car, you put it in a bag, you put it in something with a search warrant. And the Carpenter case that was talked about in the informational hearing, that's what it says. And so, and they need a search warrant for that. Maybe Mr. Evans can talk a little bit about that. But this makes it clear that if you're not putting something on a car, you don't follow 626A39. You follow the law that was passed 5 years ago. And I think it's a great clarification thing. Now, about Section 6. The definition, I really have no issue with it, but as like with anything, additional language does add things, and so I maybe that needs to be explained a little bit. Of the section that I just said, Subdivision 4, though, 520 through 524, should be taken out. The other language I think is clarifying tracking. So I'm basically saying adopt the delete everything amendment except where they're striking the language and adding language to where law enforcement becomes the notifier. Now, in a cursory look of other states, again, who have been dealing with this, I still see that it's the judiciary that notifies. So I don't know where this new thing is. So anyways, that's my two cents. I want to thank you very much. I just want, and I think your constituents want two things. One, these search warrants be public, which they should have been 5 years ago, and that people are notified. And then we, you as policymakers and lowly citizens like myself, can do the monitoring that's important. And if we see something wrong, to do some of the things like Tony Webster does or other people do, let the public know. For me, I'm one of these people that will come up and knock on your door. Hey, this is what I see. Let's do some change. So, Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, you and I, we talked about this before, about the federal law. What was it that you wanted me to clarify?
I don't remember.
Okay, sometimes there are issues of federal laws. You've got to remember, 1968 in the Streets Crime Act, all this wiretap stuff that we're dealing with today, the federal law passed it. After, and this was in your informational hearing, someone said something about cats. Well, after the cats decision in 1967, the federal government passed this wiretap language. All the states had to adopt it. The federal government sets a minimum standard, But we in Minnesota can go a little bit more, get more protection, more rights, whatever. So that's the combination. Because sometimes questions are, can you get a federal warrant, or is it the federal court? It's the state courts if they're more more restrictive and more for people's rights. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, those are my points.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, Mr. Neumeister. Yeah, you brought up some of the concerns about watching law enforcement. There's a reason law enforcement is skeptical about releasing information of the equipment they have. I've talked about this before in the past. Law enforcement is always two steps behind, which makes it very difficult for them to do things. Technology to catch up is very expensive. When they do catch up, they don't want the perpetrators that they're trying to catch to know they have that, so they change their method of operation, and now that multi-million-dollar piece of equipment is now just a boat anchor. They want to be able to use the technology, but they want to use it properly. I know, Representative Lesch, we've talked about how we handle this situation so the legislature can have the information they need, but also making sure law enforcement can do their job. I hope we can continue those conversations. And I think it's more and more very important that we get that something like that started. I'm concerned with law enforcement having the responsibility on this notification. As Representative Neumeister said, we have numerous hundreds of law enforcement agencies. We have only 87 courthouses, or 87 counties that have courthouses, but only 10 judicial districts. I think it's going to be easier to make sure that the information is going to be given out, because we might only have 10 places to go look compared to 700. So that's why I think the courts should do it. I guess I wish the courts would be here so we could ask them why they haven't been doing the notifications.
And Representative Johnson, thanks. And I just want to make sure that we stay on track as far as time, but we'll get to some more questions. But is there anybody here from either courts or law enforcement planning on testifying about this bill? Crickets. Are they coming? Okay. All right, so while we wait for that, I think Representative Lucero, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. I guess my first question for Chair Lesch or Mr. Neumeister, can you remind the original language that you were referencing back in 2014, the compromise language, what's in law now, what was the enactment date on that? And basically I'm seeking to know when was the legislature expecting this information to be reported to the legislature?
Well, that was, we passed it 2014, okay? Yeah, it started August 1st. So we expected, well, assuming that as of August 1st, these tracking warrants were being applied for, that the first ones would be disclosed, 90 days thereafter, so sometime around October, November of 2014. However, it was the Tom Lydon report in September of 2015 that indicated almost a year had gone by and there wasn't a single one that had been disclosed. And that's what kind of blew this whole thing up starting in 2015.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you. Then the next question would be, so with this clarifying language, is it the intent that it would only be from the enactment date of this going forward for the reporting, or is the intent to go retroactive back to the original intent and come forward?
Well, that's a, would you want to?
Yeah. Madam
Chair, I say from the beginning, I think that's important. That was always the intent of the legislation last year. It was the intent of the legislation in 2014, and I see that the intent of the legislation here in 2019.
Follow-up?
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. So, and I agree with you. So if that isn't in here now or if it's silent, I would just encourage the Mr. Chair to consider that if you agree.
Can I?
And then the last question, or maybe it's more of just a comment. As I'm looking at the amendment on page 4, so it's essentially lines 4.1 through 4.8, I'm seeing multiple references of the verbiage as electronic device. An electronic device is defined in current statute. But then when I read lines 4.10 through 4.13, it uses the verbiage of cell phones several times. And so perhaps there's just an opportunity here to clean that language up, because I don't see a definition for cell phones. But when I see the verbiage cell phone, what immediately jumps to my mind is we want to try to make the language, to the degree possible, not to make it dependent on technology, because my intent would be not just cell phones, but anything that would be within that category of electronic device, like iPads or other things that are not considered cell phones. So thank you, Mr. or Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, and Madam Chair, Representative Lucero. I agree, and I think there was some misunderstanding from folks who sort of came to this discussion a little bit late, that we were attempting to address just the cell phone spoofing technology, and I had to explain the whole panoply of technology slash privacy slash data issues that we've encountered over the last 10 years here, including cell phone exploitation and devices, license plate readers, body cams, facial recognition, drones, all that stuff, of how our intent is that it not be dependent on a specific type of technology. So I do agree with you, and I want us to result in that type of language and understanding.
And I have a question here just on the retroactivity piece that Representative Lucero raised, and whether, Chair Lesh, you can address if that's clear from this bill, or perhaps Mr. Hopkins could explain if that's clear.
I'd like Mr. Hopkins to explain if that's in here or not.
Representative Lesh, members. So the bill doesn't have a enactment date specified, so it would have default enactment date of August 1st of this year, if it were to pass this year. In current law, the report that's required to be filed by the judiciary to the legislature is filed on or before November 15th of each even-numbered year. So the next report would be due in November 15th of 2020, and that report is required to look back over the last 2 years. So the report would look back starting in November of 2018. And those reporting requirements are in current statute, which isn't affected by the bill.
Mr. Chair, did you have a comment on that? Or?
Well, I'm going to want to change it so that it is retroactive then, and we'll see what happens after that. I'm sure there'll be like whack-a-mole, someone else will pop up and have a problem with it.
Yep. I see that you have a response, Mr. Newsmeister, but I want to be clear on time here. It looks like we have other people who want to testify too, so if just you can hold that thought and we can get to the other folks, unless members have other questions right now for Mr. Newmeister. Chair Scott.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have one for Mr. Newmeister, but I do for Chair Lesh.
Go ahead.
Did you reach out to the courts, Chair Lesh, and ask them to be here to testify on behalf of themselves? Because it seems it's really hard to get them here to do that sort of thing, but I didn't know if you had in any way reached out to them, or had they contacted you regarding this issue.
Well, Madam Chair and Chair Scott, yes. I've had several individuals in the court system. As you know, judicial branch individuals are paranoid about speaking on the record in the legislature. And I specifically stated that I would hold harmless and not disclose who I talked to. But it does make it really difficult. Because the way we do legislation here is on the record, so everyone states their concerns, we're all on the same page. So I feel like I'm trying to juggle some flaming swords here in that respect, and I hope we get it right, but that's what I'm dealing with.
Thank you.
Okay, so it looks like we have some other people who want to testify. Please come forward and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom Freeman, worked for Fager Baker Daniels, represent the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. Much has been already discussed. Just want to go on the record. We are waiting for some more expert testimony and told Chair Lesh that we'd like to work with him going forward, but our concerns do revolve around the notification piece that's been discussed before the committee. We felt that the bill last year and the, you know, the impetus for that bill was to fix what was going on in the court system, and we think that this is a major change in what folks had agreed to last year, and just want to state that on the record and let Author and Chair Lesh know that we'll look forward to working with them.
Okay. Thank you.
Eric Hyland, representing the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I'd like to echo what Mr. Freeman said and also make it very clear that I think all two associations were comfortable and didn't have major issues with the bill as introduced. The Delete Everything Amendment adds a bit of uncertainty that we're just, quite frankly, trying to figure it out. So continue to work with the Chairman Lesh on this one.
Thank you. Thanks for coming forward today. Does anyone have questions for Mr. Freeman or Mr. Hyland? Okay. Someone else, come on forward, please. Go ahead, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I just want to echo what the associations had said as well, in that we fully support, from our perspective, the clarification, and I do think the original bill did clarify your legislative intent originally to ensure that there is sunshine on these orders and that they are public. I do agree with Chair Lesh that there's been some confusion over what the original intent of the language was from the judiciary standpoint, and that attempts to clarify it. We do have some concerns about pieces of the Delete Everything Amendment in terms of notification statewide and what that may mean, and we're still analyzing the new definition of the cell site simulator. I understand Chair Lesh's wish to be beyond cell phones, which we do consider now from our perspective. There's just some provisions in there. We need to think through what they may mean from a overall technology standpoint, but support the everyone's wish to have further clarification as to what that may mean and what we're trying to encompass in this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Representative Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Deputy Evans, how many different departments are there in the state of Minnesota that could possibly use these that would be affected by this change?
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, there's over 430 law enforcement agencies in the state currently.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair. That's my concern. There's over 400 agencies that would have to report to the judiciary that they had made these notifications so the judiciary could do the report. The judiciary is required to do the report to this legislative body. There's 10 judicial districts. That's only 10 places they have to contact to get the information, or 87 counties. I think it's much easier for them to get their report done at a lot less cost and a lot less headache for over 400 law enforcement agencies if you'd go back to what the original intent was and in the bill that we actually passed last year. And I understand the other changes are fine, but I think we need to keep the reporting requirements with the judiciary.
Chair Lesh.
Madam Chair, I'd like to point out, too, that, you know, when this whole brouhaha blew up in 2016 legislative session, the Superintendent Evans was very amenable. He said, yeah, we have no problem clarifying the intent, and was very cooperative. That's what we thought it meant, too, you know. So it was very easy to work with on that, and I appreciated that. I would say that at least my current understanding, and I'm not saying that this is a reason to keep it with law enforcement, but previously it was only Hennepin County and the BCA that were using Kingfish, Stingray, whatever, and I think Hennepin County stopped doing it, so it's only the BCA that's doing it. Now, that doesn't take into account other technologies that may come online, but I don't think it's as black and white as, well, now 400 law enforcement agencies are going to have to do this, because I think there might be only one, or a hand, you know, you can count them on one hand. I'm not sure. That's not a reason for me to say, well, forget it, keep it with law enforcement. Because of the awkwardness that I brought up in response to Chair Scott's question, I'm going to ask if the stakeholders can talk with the judicial branch folks offline and reach an understanding, and that way, you know, I don't have to, you know, make public sausage out of this thing. So maybe, hopefully we can do that and we can arrive at some comity on this.
Thank you. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious, when a search warrant is done and you're getting a search warrant for a specific person, is their name and address on the search warrant? I don't know if Mr. Evans, if you want to answer that.
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, if we have that information in this context, that information is typically contained in the tracking warrant. There are certain times where we don't have that information. We may have the phone device, phone number, information about that phone that we have a connection that we can illustrate through the warrant, and where it may not be contained. But typically, if we have it, we're going to include that information to make that connection to that phone.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so my point here is that the courts would have some way of getting a hold of the people that they need to after the time for these things to become public has come. Is that correct?
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, we certainly include that information most times, and the judge could always require that we give them that information before they sign the warrant.
Thank you.
Great. Any other discussion from members? All right, so hearing none, I lay House File 631 as amended over for possible inclusion in the... We're going to lay House File 631 as amended over for possible inclusion in the Data Practices Omnibus Bill. And seeing as we're short on time, our next meeting will be tomorrow, Wednesday, February 13th. We've got the court doing their budget presentation. The district court judges will be presenting a budget, and we'll be hearing one bill, House Bill
19. Madam Chair.
Oh, yes, Chair Scott.
I'm sorry. I hate to interrupt. Go ahead and finish what you were thought. But I do have a comment.
But let's go ahead.
Okay. I just do have a comment, members. And it regards the last hearing that we had in this committee. And it is in regard to decorum on this committee and others. And in my 10 years here, I've only seen probably one other instance where I saw a testifier treated so harshly, unfairly, and their comments misrepresented. And I hope that going forward that all of our testifiers are treated with respect. Thank you. That's my comment.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Scott. Chair Lesh, did you have a comment?
Well, I didn't know if anyone wanted to speak to that. It had been brought up to me by a couple of Republican members relating to Ms. Hassan's statement, Representative Hassan's statement. And I think this is something that maybe we as a committee will have to chew on. When I heard Representative Hassan's statement, I did not think it was over the top. I didn't. For this reason, we afford special privileges to members of the public who come up here who are not getting paid and testify, and we kind of prevent them from being berated for one reason or another, even if they get over the top a little bit. People who are paid to come and sit at this table, they get the full money sometimes from certain members who get upset. And I was in a public safety committee meeting last week where I thought someone went over the top in attacking the attorney general and saying, you can't be here. But the attorney general is a big boy and he can take it. Just like I think that the paid attorneys who were here at the testifiers table are big kids and they can take it. Which is why I did not say anything. And I think reasonable minds can disagree about some of the statements that are made by other folks around some of these committee tables. So while I heard from several members about Representative Hassan's statement, I had a different perspective. And I went back and I watched the tape to see exactly what she said and how she said it. And for me, it still did not go over the top. So I am willing to entertain comments about that with respect to decorum, but I also think that it is highly subjective, and it's based on various factors that we bring to the table. So that's what I wanted to say about it. And I welcome anyone to be heard on the record about a response to that of how I'm wrong about that as well.
Okay, members, seeing as we have about a minute left, any further? Yes, Representative Robbins.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Lesh. Just to clarify the record, that witness was volunteering her time. She is not a paid lobbyist. She was just offering her expertise. She was not someone who's paid or a lobbyist here. Thank you.
Well, I mean, we probably don't need to go into details about it, but I would note that there are plenty of people who come up who are business owners who don't necessarily get paid to sit at this table. They're not clocking in and clocking out, but it's still their business. It's what they do, and it's their livelihood, and so that was my perspective on it.
Anything else? Meeting is adjourned.